Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
I'm sure most of you already know this, but some might have forgotten. So just as a quick refresher, the Phileas Club is entirely financed by its Patreon. The patrons who decide to give a little bit of money, a little bit of value to the show, are the people who make it possible. So if you think that this show is somehow entertaining, fun, or interesting, or has some kind of value for you, please do consider giving a little bit of value back. And thanks a million to those who already do. This is the Phileas Club, episode 118. If you think you understand. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Phileas Club. This is the show where we cover, well, I guess we cover the news from the world, but not really. We cover the news that are important in each of our local areas of said world. Local areas might be quite large, but we try to focus on those with, well, I mean, sometimes they're world impacting news, but we try to focus on them with local opinions and our cultural backgrounds, and try to give you our different takes on those local news, try to give you different opinions on those that you might not have had, although sometimes it's exactly what you expect. Today, I'm very glad. Oh, first of all, my name is Patrick Beja, and I'm currently living in Finland, but I'm originally from France, and I have news from both of those countries. And we also have other people from the Western world this time. Tom Merritt is here with us from Thanksgiving-riddled California.
Yes, it is just peppered with Thanksgiving everywhere. The uniquely American holiday, Thanksgiving. Although I guess Canada has their own, it's not the same day as ours. So yeah, it's that one holiday that we all celebrate for sure and no one else does.
There aren't many of those, I suppose. There are versions of every holiday, different versions of most holidays in every country. Yeah, Thanksgiving, yeah. Though... If you don't include that weird Canadian one, which I'm guessing is a copy of the American one, because everything in Canada is a kinder copy of the American version.
They're so sorry about it, but they come.
So yeah, thanks for being on with us. You're going to be talking about fires. And
yes, I like to think that I am... living in California, but originally from Illinois, which distance-wise is kind of like being from France and living in Finland, although it's still all America. And California has always suffered fires. That is not unusual, but the fires have gotten worse and worse, and there is an effect of climate change that is fueling that. There are other reasons that are fueling that as well. And this year, one of the worst, if not, I think it may have been determined to be the worst fire on record in California, happened in Northern California. We had two very damaging fires in Southern California. And I have relatives up in San Jose that we traveled to visit. So I sort of got a boots on the ground inhalation of smoke in both locations.
Okay. Well, I mean, I'm sure a lot of listeners, most listeners, have heard about this, even if they're not in the U.S., mostly because it was, you know, present all over social networks and podcasts. Yeah. I think
many podcasters celebrities
are. Yeah, for me, it wasn't so much the celebrities, although I guess podcasting celebrities.
That's how it gets
celebrities.
In the news. Yeah,
right. Because every podcast I listen to, or many of them, are recorded in California. And
right,
so,
right.
Yeah. But we'll get a little bit more details on that and maybe some of the context surrounding it. We also have Bruce from Scotland, / Hello. The United Kingdom. How's it going, Bruce?
Yeah, it's going.
So, it's going. Yeah, you are going to be talking to us about Brexit, which is its own special brand of, I don't know, I was going to say forest fire. I was going to say dumpster fire, but I don't want to, you know, make fun of fires because it's not fun at the moment. But,
being the person in California affected them, I think you can compare Brexit to a kind of fire, and it's not too offending.
Now, you asked me to be as impartial as possible, and this is how you open it.
Yeah, well, I mean, the thing is, I think the unique situation of Brexit currently is that after, 2 years of negotiations, both sides are still incredibly unhappy about everything. And I think in that sense, it's fine to say it's a dumpster fire and still be neutral because everyone thinks it's a dumpster fire.
So, I don't think anyone is happy at the moment. So, yeah, I do agree here.
So we'll dive into this. And your tone is sort of, well, I guess setting the tone for the tone of that conversation. So we'll see where we get with that. I'll also be talking about stuff from Finland and from France. Finland has to do with babies, and France has to do with, you know, those security jackets, like the yellow reflective jackets?
The high visibility, high vis, they call
those things. Yeah. Well, it has to do with that. And you might think, oh, it's going to be the funny, you know, kicker story. That's the feel-good one. It really isn't. I mean, it's not horrible, but it's kind of a possibly a moment of reckoning for the country / the government. But we'll talk about this in just a little bit. I think first, you know what? Let's get the depression out of the way. and talk about Brexit, which I think has been making the news, I want to say worldwide. I'm going to open the Brexit segment with asking Tom, actually, if some Brexit managed to make the news between two forest fires.
Yes, it absolutely did. Although I'm always a horrible test case for this because I get my news from The Economist and the BBC, which are both British-based publications. But even so, I think Brexit has been something that people have heard of. I'm over in the United States quite a bit. It's at the top of the news, and I've been following the mess that it is with great interest to the point that, you know, at one point I tweeted last week that this season of House of Cards is great. And of course, I'm referring to Theresa May's administration, not the one on Netflix, because it has just been fascinating, not necessarily in a positive way, but fascinating to just watch the slow motion wreck that is happening as they essentially, from my perspective, get caught up on how to treat a border that they want to leave open while closing the rest of the border.
Yeah, it seems that's the key point. But let's get to Bruce. And so tell us, from here, we've been hearing they found a deal and no one likes that deal. And we're like, what the hell do you want? And so, Bruce, tell us, what do you want?
What do we want? What do the British people want? To be great again, I think, just like America. it all started way back about what feels like months ago, but I think it was only a couple of weeks, where Theresa May came up and said they'd been in with her cabinet and they got a deal and everyone would support it. And it was fantastic. And, you know, she was glad that everyone had agreed to it. It later turned out it was a majority vote. So the cabinet that had voted on it were deeply split. This is my understanding of it. And then the next day, the Brexit secretary, Dominic Raab, came out and resigned because he didn't, his words were, cannot in good conscience support the terms proposed for our deal with the EU. And following that, I think the last count was up to 19 Conservative ministers resigned their posts in protest of the deal. basically saying that it wasn't what we voted for. I'm putting up
What we voted for, you mean during the Brexit vote?
Yeah. I'm putting up my fingers here and in inverted commas, which is great podcast.
So I understand the process here, the proposal was essentially agreed upon. Supposedly with the agreement of the Brexit minister, I'm guessing.
Yes.
And then it was made public and the EU was okay with it. And Theresa May, at least, was okay with it. And the high government officials of the UK were supposedly okay with it. Then it was made public. And the people who, like, in order for it to pass, it would have needed to be voted on by what, Parliament, I'm guessing?
Yeah, it needs to go through Parliament, which is going to happen in the next, I think it's over the weekend where it's going to be, or close to it, where it's going to be voted on. But back then it was my understanding that was before it went to the EU. It was basically internally agreeing the deal that what we wanted to propose, given all the negotiations that had happened with the EU and what we thought the EU would agree with.
Right. I'm guessing in that case, they would probably draft something that they think the EU would be okay with. With a few details, maybe.
Yeah. Okay. When the details of the deal had been published, you can understand why the hardline Brexiteers are not very happy with it. It basically what it does is it means that we leave the EU, but we still retain the laws, some form of judicial oversight. So the European Court of Justice will still have a say. There would still be a customs union with some, and I've been trying to figure this out, some kind of technological solution to the Irish border problem, which, if people don't know about, Northern Ireland is a part of the United Kingdom, and it is on the same island as the Republic of Ireland. And the Good Friday Agreement, which was agreed, I might get this wrong, 1998 or 99, by Tony Blair at the time, basically it was an agreement between Ireland and the UK that there will never be a hard border between Northern Ireland and Ireland, but that Northern Ireland would stay within the United Kingdom.
And that, my understanding is that, at least looking at it from the outside, this is the main issue that is blocking everything else. But I think what you're saying is it isn't really the only one, because there are issues of oversight. And correct me if I'm wrong. The way you're describing it is the Brexit deal is kind of Brexiting without really Brexiting. Like, is it?
That's why I can only laugh. I'm trying to explain this in terms that make sense, but it doesn't make sense to me, because the deal says we will leave the EU, but we will stay within the customs union for the moment. But there will be a technological solution in the future that will solve the issue of the border, because the two proposals are, one is you'd have to put a border at between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland, and that completely nullifies the Good Friday Agreement, and that wouldn't be very good for the region. The troubles in Ireland were all about that. The other solution, which the unionist Irish are very unhappy about, is to put a border within the sea, so between Ireland and the United Kingdom. And they say, well, you know, we're not going to be part of Ireland anymore. We're not going to be part of the United Kingdom anymore. So, you know, that there's that.
So but this is definitely
figure out.
Yeah, this is definitely, I mean, the Irish border issue. For those who don't know about this issue, it's possible they don't. As you're describing it, it's kind of unsolvable because the EU borders are open between the countries of the EU. And Ireland, the Republic of Ireland, is part of the EU. But Northern Ireland is part of the UK. And of course, one of the main contentions of the Brexit is that the UK wants to control its own borders. So the border between Northern Ireland and Ireland is kind of either it's open and then the UK has a border open with the EU, which Brexit doesn't want. I'm treating Brexit as a, you know, sentient entity at this point. Or it's closed, and that's not okay because obviously in the UK, as you explained, they don't want that border to be closed. So I guess my question is, what do hardline Brexiters propose as a solution to this problem?
Well, it's what they've said is, you know, we'll use technology. That's basically what their
result is. Blockchain AI will solve it.
Well, you know, to use a famous phrase now, we've all got mobile phones, so you know, why don't we just use those to track where people are, etc. That was one of the comments that came up.
What? Yeah, how does that, like, you're tracking every person in real time in Ireland? How does that help? First of all, I'm guessing people who want the Brexit want the closed border because they want to make sure no, you know, unsavory people get into the country. I'm quite certain that people can leave their cell phone at home and cross the border and they wouldn't be tracked.
Well,
they'd be so bored, Patrick.
That's very advanced thinking of you leaving your cell phone at home and going. I don't think anyone thought of that, Patrick.
I know. I'm advanced. Thank you.
You sneaky Europeans. You.
I mean, no, we're not even mentioning the issues
in the first place.
I'm not even mentioning the issues of, you know, privacy problems. But
yeah, this is an issue, and it's one that I don't think has been sorted out. And there have been discussions about, well, you know, maybe Northern Ireland is a special case because Northern Ireland did vote Remain. So maybe we should give them a bit of a pass. And that comes into problems because Scotland also voted Remain. Overwhelmingly. So it's a situation now where England and Wales have voted for something and they want to keep the union together, but they want to leave the EU. But Northern Ireland and Scotland are saying, well, you know.
But so that problem has existed since the beginning of the Brexit negotiations. Yeah. What's new now is that there was a deal that was agreed upon, at least in the UK, but essentially is the government seems to be disintegrating following that package that was put together.
That's effectively what's happening. I'm surprised today that it's, you know, that Theresa May is still in power. I think it's a situation where there's just nothing to fill the void if she were to go. So nobody wants to push that house of cards down because the opposition, the Labour Party, Jeremy Corbyn, if he wanted to, he could win a landslide election if he just said one word of support for Remain. Okay, in my opinion, he could win a landslide election, but he's not, and he is coming from a very far left point of view. In that he hasn't said it outright, but I think he wants to leave the EU too for different reasons. He's very much in the mind that everything should be renationalized, the railways. He doesn't want the NHS to be sold off, which is fine. You know, I wouldn't want that too. But he's very much a socialist in that he wants.
Well, I'm sure he could do that within the confines of the EU. Although the railways, you need to have competition, but you can have one. Yeah, it's yeah. maybe a little
there, bit. There are competition laws within the EU that would block his idea of, you know, the nation as a whole, and almost it is socialist. It's socialist. Okay. It's not communist.
So, all right. So yeah. By the way, socialism and communism, as they are implemented now, very different things. It annoys me to no end to hear Americans use socialism when they mean communism, even though, of course, you know, historically the term is what it is. But anyway, I feel like I'm not really understanding what's happening still, Bruce.
Can I throw in, you know, two perspectives from just following the story that I don't think help you understand it, but are important to consider. One is that this isn't even the Brexit agreement. This is the agreement of what we'll do in the transition period after the Brexit to happen in March, because we haven't figured out what to do. So they're still like they're just agreeing like, okay, we'll have a transition period where you'll still be part of the customs union, and this is what will happen to residents while we still figure out what this is going to be. And the other point to consider is, especially regarding that Irish border, Theresa May's government is not a majority government. It's a coalition government with the Democratic Unionist Party from Ireland, who are very opposed to this Brexit agreement that Theresa May is bringing, which, you know, adds to that flavor of her administration, you know, teetering on the edge, because she's trying to keep them happy. And that is the biggest problem, is whether to have a border or not. And the DUP is, you know, unionist is right there in the name, isn't necessarily the friendliest party to some kind of compromise where they would put a border in the Irish Sea or something like that.
Yeah, but you know, we're kind of laughing off this border issue, but for all of the discussions and all of the reporting I've seen and read, no one is proposing anything that actually solves it.
No,
you know, it is unsolvable. And it's staggering that no one is actually saying, you know, everything about Brexit is somehow solvable. You know, you could have a hard Brexit. Like, that's the responses I've gotten.
You could have it, I guess.
Well, I mean, but theoretically. It's not, obviously, it's not a good idea. But the answer I've gotten from people is, well, just do a hard Brexit. And without, you know, I think only the hardest core of the hardcore Brexiters are arguing that this would be fine. I think everyone else understands a hard Brexit would not be, you know, I think there's this idea that the hard Brexit would be 3 months of difficulties economically, and then it would be fine, and you know, the UK would be super happy. And there's only a few people who think that. Everyone else understands it would wreck the economy. It would be chaos in the country, and people would lose their jobs.
It might bring back the troubles in Ireland if you did a hard Brexit.
Yeah, on top of that. So the hard Brexit, in theory, it could happen. This border issue literally has no solution. So as long as you make it a condition to an agreement for the Brexit, it just can't happen. The entire focus of this entire conversation should be, do you have a solution for that Irish border? And my understanding, Bruce, is that this is not what the conversation is. It's devolving into, oh, we can Brexit. No, we can't Brexit. Without this focus on the Irish border, right?
Well, this is what you've both said there, Tom and Patrick, is exactly the issue. Is that there is no solution here that especially no solution that makes the hard Brexit, the hard right, happy. It's just not. It's too intertwined at the moment. Analogy of taking eggs out of a cake. You know, we want to take the eggs back from the cake, but we've already baked the cake. We can't take the eggs. And there's some truth to that, in that there's a lot of Europeanness and a lot of, you know, the way things work now, there's things that we take for granted that are going to go. And people are just now realizing that it's a very simple thing. If you visit Europe from the UK now, You don't necessarily need to take a passport. You walk straight through automated checkpoints. I went to Belgium a couple of weeks ago, and I walked straight through. Nothing, you know. You just look into a camera and go, and it's very easy to do. And now people are being told, well, you know, you're not going to be able to do that anymore. You're going to have to get into the queue with non-EU members. And people are like, what? You know, how and can they do this?
Come on over, everybody. It's fun over there.
Europe are just trying to punish us. No, what Europe are doing are securing their borders.
So there's this real issue.
Yeah, go ahead. Sorry.
So to harp on this a little bit, but do you think, because this was what I think, from my point of view, everyone had been saying from the start, you know, this whole Brexit conversation 2 years ago, people were saying, well, if you Brexit, you can't come in without a passport or visa, or, you know, you might have an agreement with the EU, but you still need your passport, right? And you come in with the non-EU members. And how are people only realizing this now, I guess, is my first question. And the second one is, do you think it's very difficult to assess the opinion of the entire country, especially from your bubble? But do you think if the vote was taken again today, I'm sure there are hardcore Brexiters which would, no matter what happens, they would still want to Brexit. And some people that are unhappy, that feel cheated, whatever. But do you think the vote would have a different result nowadays?
Well, this is another point I was going to bring up is there have been polls recently, and they are all swinging Remain 55-45% now. Mm. There is a growing movement. There was a march in London a few weeks ago where 700,000 people march through London carrying European flags. There's a movement called Our Future, Our Choice, which is absolutely amazing. There's a guy called, I have to actually read his name because his surname's Femi Oluwole, O-L-U-W-O-L-E. He's on Twitter, and he started out as a student on the streets the day after the Brexit vote with a handwritten T-shirt, and he's turned it into this huge movement, basically saying, his message is, by the time Brexit happens, those of voting age will be overwhelmingly pro-Remain, because people who have turned 18 in that time, you know, the younger vote is very much pro Remain, and they see it. And his message is, the older population have voted to leave, but actually, the country is going to be, you know, for the younger people in 50 years' time, etc., when the older people are going to go. And the Brexit movement are now saying, well, we are going to take a hit. We're not going to have more money. You know, the NHS is not going to have £350 million a week. In fact, you're going to have to cut back a bit more. We're going to have to, you know, tighten our belts for a little bit. There's people saying, you know, we did this after World War II. We had rationing. We can do it again. And, you know, people who voted Remain are saying, well, why are we doing this? You know, the government is stockpiling medicines because there might be problems with the border after 29th of March next year. We're being told all sorts of things about they're building a car park, huge truck stop, apparently. I'm not necessarily they're building a huge truck stop because they know in Kent, which is down by Dover, so that they can park all the trucks that are going to be waiting for customs checks. And the local residents all voted. That was a very leave area, and they're turning around saying, what's this? You know, this isn't what we voted for. It was actually, this is.
So your impression is that, and again, I know there are some people listening to this who lean towards Brexit, who are saying, you're biased, and, you know, but what's happening now is what we were saying was going to happen. And I think, okay, to give the other perspective, there are some people who are saying, well, Theresa May never really wanted to Brexit, so she dragged her heels
and
didn't prepare for a hard Brexit, which could have been ready by now after 18 months or whatever. And now, of course, it's impossible, but it could have been done. And so she's forcing the deal she is putting together down our throats, but because she didn't prepare adequately.
Yeah. Yes, and people are saying that, and they're all clinging to that and saying that, you know, this should have been sorted out years ago, months ago. But 2 years ago, after the Brexit vote, they said this is going to be the easiest deal in history. They said it was going to be so simple, there wouldn't be any issues with it. We'll just push it through.
Oh, and, meaning they did a hard Brexit wasn't really needed. You could negotiate your Brexit with the EU and it was going to be easy.
Yeah, we'd be like Norway or something like that. And and they said after the Brexit vote, a lot of people backtracked and said, well, you know, we didn't really say we were going for a hard Brexit. We'll just go for a soft one. And event. And what's happened now within the Conservative government is that they've all gone hard Brexit. A part of me thinks, well, maybe Theresa May said, OK, well, you hardliners take the reins and let's see you fail miserably. And then, you know, I'll pick up the pieces once you're done. I don't know. I don't know if it's a long play by her, but it's a very risky one if she's doing it. And she is actually playing with people's lives, because there are people with, people with diabetes who might not get their insulin, etc. And we don't have a culture here of GoFundMe pages for people who need medicine. So it is an issue. And then I'll just throw in one more thing that's come up today, is Spain have turned around and said, well, what's going to happen with Gibraltar? Because Gibraltar is a British territory, and they're not happy with the arrangements that have been made. They don't want... Yeah. They don't want it. And apparently Argentina is sitting by because they think Britain's weak now and going to want to, I know they're not in Europe, but they, you know, they're eyeing the Falklands up again. It's very difficult. There are lots of things within the deal that don't make sense.
That's the most disheartening thing. And the thing that strikes, I think, us in France and to be honest, in the entire EU, even the anti-EU sentiments from the far right and far left that were displayed in the last election in 2017, I think, have been kind of calmed because people realized that wasn't holding in France. There were, you know, some fringe people who were like, EU sucks. But overall, the French population likes the idea of the EU, even if there are things that need to be fixed. Mm-hmm. And so we're looking at this and thinking, what the hell are you doing? And, you know, it was bad enough when the Brexit was voted and when the negotiations started. But now it's like, I made the joke on Twitter that in the US, that the Brexit makes Trump look reasonable. Because a lot of the, you know, I've been saying this, a lot of the policies that Trump has been implementing or his government have been implementing, I don't think would have been very different if someone else had been in place. So, another conservative, of course, you know, if Rubio or whatever a GOP candidate had been elected, I think most of the actual policies would have been somewhat similar. Maybe not as extreme, but it's not like the entire thing would have been different.
They would have had nicer Twitter posts to go along with that.
That's for sure. So in effect, what Trump is doing is a lot of noise, but I don't think in policy. And I think, you know, transgender people might take issue with what I'm saying here. The ban on Muslim countries, quote unquote. Yes, I agree. But, you know, overall, in the case of Brexit, it was pretty bad to begin with. And now it's kind of this explosion of nonsense and, you know, it's not misunderstanding. In French, you can say, there's no understanding of anything that's happening. It's bewilderment, I guess. But anyway. Yeah, all right. We have to move on, but go ahead.
Yep. No, I'm just going to say, and people in Scotland are getting more and more frustrated. Nicola Sturgeon was only notified of the deal. I think it was the day after it was agreed, and she was summoned to Westminster on, I think it was the Tuesday. And she, you know, she had commitments, so she couldn't go. So the so Theresa May said, "Oh, she's ignoring us. She doesn't want to be involved." Yet she hasn't been involved the whole way. She was just summoned to have a look and discuss it. So there are things rumbling. I don't know what's going to happen. It feels like, you know, I just one more thing on Brexit is that one of the other things, I work in local government, and one of the things about government, local government, I think it's all over the world, is that things move slowly. And even if we had had a good deal agreed within 6 months of the Brexit vote, we would leaving on the 29th of March was not realistic. The area where I work, we're deciding whether to outsource a service or to keep it in-house or to split it, etc. And it's recognized that this is just one service within the local council and a couple of businesses. That's going to take about 2 years to sort out. I don't see Brexit. I don't see the United Kingdom disassembling all its little fingers in Europe, you know, Euratom and obviously the courts and all of these things, without long and lengthy individual negotiations with all of those things. Even if it's a 500-page document, it's not going to cover things. So there's a reality that I think nobody's actually realized is the administration required to push this through is going to take a long time. Anything else is not reality. So,
I think there's a sentiment that this administrative slowness and heaviness comes from the EU, which is not the case. You know, governments are machines that are very complicated. I hate to say, especially in the US, there's this sentiment that that governments are inefficient and essentially crap, and that if only we could do without the government, everything would be great. But it's only because you essentially assign every difficult job to the government, and it is difficult and it takes time and people and minutiae, and the people who do it are qualified people who spend time doing this. So of course, as with the EU, there can always be improvements. But in the case of the administration of Great Britain and of the UK, this has been built as a nation, an empire, a union over, depending how you look at it, 50 years or hundreds of years, and you can't fix it. You can't change it fundamentally in 6 months or in 2 years. It takes, a decade.
Listen, 15. If you had a stronger negotiator who wouldn't let the EU push Theresa May around, this would have gotten done, you guys. All right? You just need to not let them force you into agreeing to some backstop customs union. The UK can survive a hard Brexit on its own. It's a strong economy. It can make deals with the US and make deals better on its own. Theresa May just needs a little more backbone to make this work.
So, Tom, you're joking, I think.
I'm not joking. I am expressing the leave opinion for those listening.
I'll say one thing about Theresa May. She's getting bashed from every side. I think, and I don't know enough about her, so I might be completely wrong, but I really think she's a hero. And she is taking everything on the chin and still doing the response. She could just, throw her hands in the air and say, "You want a hard Brexit? Fine, we're hard Brexiting now. Have fun and leave." She could absolutely do a number of things that would appear to get to do what people want. But obviously, in the end, the British population would suffer immensely. And she's doing the responsible thing, trying to keep this whole thing together, and becoming immensely unpopular with the entire population in the process, but she's still doing it. I don't know. It seems to me like that's
her name's
happening.
Theresa May, not Theresa Will.
Two things, and it'll be the last I say on it. One is I'm beginning to see what you say there about Theresa May. I was very anti her, but more recently I'm seeing she's doing what she can with the tools. The second is my response to that Lever who was on here with the American accent, but you know, might be. is that it doesn't matter how much you how much will you have and how much belief in yourself you have, you cannot negotiate with a horse trader to get a unicorn. It just is not possible. So, you know, this is what it is. The British want a unicorn. The EU is saying, we'll give you this horse. That's all we can give you. So that's my final word on the matter. And I'm sorry, Patrick, you sent me a message and said, please be as impartial as possible. But I can't. I just can't anymore.
I think this is, I mean, I agree with you. And I don't know.
I would love you to have a hardcore Brexiter come on this on your podcast. I'd love to hear their views on this. I think
I might be wrong, and I'm sure we're going to get some I'm going to get some messages. For some reason, for this show, people prefer to send me private messages than comment on the blog. Which please come and comment on the blog. But usually, what I've gotten is we can just hard Brexit. It's not that hard. Well, actually, it is a hard Brexit.
It won't be as bad as everyone says.
Exactly. Yeah. It won't be as bad as everyone says, which, I mean, sure, maybe. I really don't think so, but anyway. Okay, just to round off the conversation about Brexit, because we do have to move on. Yes. Tom, you joked about the Brexiter. You didn't joke. You presented the Brexiter arguments.
Thank you.
What does the U.S. think about this?
The
U.S. as a whole, it's one unified opinion about the Brexit.
It's always difficult for me to say because my perspective is not typical of the U.S. perspective. But largely, it comes down to your political party here. Politics is such a team sport right now. If you're a Democrat, you think it's all crazy and it's Trump-like people trying to ruin Britain, but we've got enough problems over here on our own. Hopefully, you know, good luck over there. And if you're a Republican, it's, you know, people are making a bigger deal out of that than it is. I'm sure they'll be fine. Good for them for fighting for economic independence. Go team Brexit. But we have enough troubles over here, so good luck with that. So the unifying theme is sort of like, wow, that's interesting. Good luck with that. We've got a lot going on here.
I will admit that I think the pictures being painted of a post-hard Brexit UK are a little bit, you know, post-apocalyptic, like Walking Dead type thing, and I think that's a little bit exaggerated. I do think it would be economically very difficult, and the people who voted for Brexit would be worse off than they were before, and would probably blame Theresa May for it, even if she did what they asked for, which is a hard Brexit. But anyway, okay. Go ahead, Bruce, and then we.
No, I'm just saying it's not going to be as bad as it's not going to be Walking Dead, but we're already feeling the impact of Brexit. People are leaving, Europeans are leaving. They don't know. Companies are pulling out. You know, there was a case last week where I think it's in Llanelli, I can't say it properly, in Wales, a big car manufacturer have pulled out, said, no, we can't deal with this uncertainty, so we're moving our factory. And this was something that was said. So people are already losing their jobs. And it's unfortunate that the people who are going to get hit worst are the ones who voted leave. They wanted to stand up and say to the government, listen to us. You've ignored us for too long, but they're the ones who are going to get hit the most. So, you know, the Brexit voter, as much as we can laugh and say, ho, 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 you're not very worldly, are you? You've got to sort of sit and say, well, why did they vote that way? And I urge anyone to follow, I'll maybe give his his details to Patrick Femi on Twitter, because he does argue this a lot better than I could, and he's really worth listening to. He wants to understand why people voted for Brexit, and he wants to convince people that it's not a good idea because of what he sees. So anyway, I said that was the last thing, and then
That's fine. It's definitely our main conversation today, and I think what comes out of it is we don't understand what's happening. And the tragedy is that no one is understanding what's happening. No one. Not the leavers, not the remainers, not the government, not the EU, no one.
When I went back to live in Zimbabwe in 2010, there was a saying there that said, if you say you understand Zimbabwean politics, then you don't. And I think that comes, you know, that's Brexit right now. If you think you understand it, actually you don't, because that's the way I see it. Yeah. Maybe I'm just dumb.
Well, if you think you understand it, it's going to make for a great title. So thank you. Tom, what is happening in California? Apparently. So first of all, what is happening and how are your two crazy political parties making it about the fact that the other one is the worst thing ever invented?
Yeah, I'll deal with what's happening first. That's the easier question. What happening is the state is now smoldering, but not burning. And for the large part of the last month, large areas of the state have been on fire. There is part of this that I think is misunderstood is that forest fires happen. You will never not have forest fires. However, forest fires don't need to happen as often as they're happening, and they don't need to happen in as large of a scale as they're happening. There were three big fires. There were a lot more than three, but there were three big fires. One is the Camp Fire up in Northern California that was started out in a place called Paradise outside of Sacramento. That's nearer to San Francisco. It's on that end of the state. And then there was the Hill Fire and the Woolsey Fire down in Southern California, both just sort of in the northern area of the Los Angeles region. The Hill Fire was the least of the three, so I'm not going to talk about that as much. The Woolsey Fire was a big fire. We had a lot of smoke here in Los Angeles to the point that you really shouldn't have been walking outside without a mask, even in my neighborhood. And it got a lot of attention because it burned down through Malibu, where a lot of celebrities live. So there was, you know, there was that added item of interest to that fire, where you had celebrities' houses burning down. Miley Cyrus lost her house, for instance. And that always adds a little, you know, you can't help but like, wow, it's not just, you know, a poor person lost their house, but this is a person I've heard of and is very famous. However, the biggest fire and the most tragic fire and the one that cost hundreds of people their lives is the Paradise area fire, the Camp Fire. I'm sorry. Yeah, that's right. And that fire, even last weekend, I was up in the Bay Area visiting family, and there was still smoke in the air. It was still unhealthy to be outside. It was just getting to the point where you didn't necessarily have to wear a mask if you weren't sensitive to it, but it was bad. And the cause of these fires is still being determined. They believe humans may have been at fault in one of the Southern Californian fires. For basically, I guess it could be considered arson, but probably more negligence. They believe that the fire up in Northern California was possibly caused by an electrical fault from the power company, sparks being thrown off. And in all of those cases, the dry conditions of California, the fact that we haven't had a lot of rain, exacerbates it. It makes the fires easier to catch, and it makes them spread faster. What has happened is tragic, and what I want to say is that the emergency personnel, the firefighters in the state of California, have done a heroic, unbelievable job in being able to contain and fight something that honestly looked impossible at one point. The Woolsey fire here in Southern California took a week to get contained at all. It was just burning out of control. Even worse was that campfire up in Paradise in Northern California, which took weeks to get any kind of containment on. So these were impossible situations that state personnel, government personnel, firefighters, and emergency personnel were able to save lives. Even as many lives as were lost, we're able to save lives, save property, and pull off an impossible job.
So when you say, you know, it was impossible to fight, was the expectation that the fires would keep burning and like burn down all of California? Like, I have a hard time understanding.
Well, maybe not all of California. It's a very big right. state. But that they would not end until they burned themselves out. They could have burned into cities, you know, if not properly contained. So yeah, there were points in the Woolsey fire, and there were a lot of points in the Hill fire where it was uncertain where it would end, where the fire would stop, and it was at the mercy of the winds and the weather what it was going to do.
I see.
I had friends who were evacuated for a week from their house here in the Los Angeles area. Their house is fine. The fire didn't get to them, but they weren't there. It was dangerous for them to go there because no one knew.
Right, right. Okay. So I hate to do this, but I'm going to do it anyway, because, again, the perspective from the outside is, at least for me, it was this. One thing that was really shocking when this whole thing started, I think 10 days ago, was the thing that President Trump tweeted. I'm sorry, I know, but I just...
No, it's I just was going to go there, and I made you go there for me, so, you know.
Okay, well, excellent. I'm happy to be a service. But, you know, we're talking about, you know, not understanding things. But there was one tweet by President Trump who is not known for his restraint on social media, but this one was like, to me, it was above everything else, where he was essentially saying, you know, putting the blame on California. We don't need to get into it too much.
No, it was a dirty trick. What President Trump does, in my opinion, is says things a lot on Twitter, mostly, in order to fire up his base and get the opposition angry at him so that they say and do things that also fire up his base. It's a brilliant strategy.
Right. So I guess
Hold on. I generally ignore everything he says on Twitter. And I 100% agree with you earlier that a large portion, not everything, but a large portion of what his administration has done would have been done by another Republican administration. And he is not nearly as controversial as he wants his opposition to treat him. This was an example of that. He knew if he went on Twitter and said, well, you know, California had better forestry management, this wouldn't happen, that it would get a lot of people angry and yelling at him. And that's what he wants. However, this is one where I personally being affected, walking outside and not being able to breathe in two areas of the state over the period of a month, didn't appreciate. The folks that were fighting this fire did not need to have the population stirred up at that time by some kind of partisan rhetoric trick. It just wasn't nice. And thankfully, you know, the folks on the ground who were fighting the fire did the right thing. They ignored it and they got on with the job of fighting the fire. Forestry management certainly could be better. It always could be better. And in fact, Governor Jerry Brown, our governor, has issued some orders in the wake of the fire to allow for more thinning of the forests, which would you know, retard forest fires in the future. And that's an adjustment that could and should be made. But politicizing it like that at that moment really did not go well down with all Californians, no matter what political stripe you were.
Yeah, it's not like California. It's you know, overall, like Trump to begin with. But it's interesting that you said
There's a lot of Trump support in California, sure, especially in the Valley and especially in the outer counties.
It's interesting that you said, you know, me being affected by the thing he was talking about, I didn't appreciate it. That's I don't know. It's interesting because, you know,
it makes it harder to ignore, right?
Exactly.
Talking about the economy or something like that, I'm like, hey, that's what he says on Twitter. He wants you to get mad. Don't feed the beast. But when you're sitting here thinking like, gosh, we need help, we need support, we need everybody to get together and unite whatever political stripe to fight this. And then the president is leading the way by criticizing forestry management. It's just disheartening.
Right. My point was going to be, it's, you know, the other people that he's talking about are probably feeling the same way when he's talking about them, when we might look at it and think, oh, you know, just ignore him. He's just making noise.
Yeah, yeah.
So,
right. And you're right. You should. It just makes it harder.
Yeah.
That's why it's such an effective strategy, right?
The other question I wanted to ask was, did his base have a little bit of a reaction, you know, to this, thinking, dude, okay, that's maybe, you know, was he as effective with this as he was with his usual Twitter inflammatory rhetoric, or was there a little bit of a reaction to this on, you know, conservative media like Fox News or whatever? Maybe you don't.
I don't know. I don't watch or consume conservative or liberal media, either one. So I couldn't tell you. I haven't spoken to anyone who's a big Trump supporter about that particular thing. I'd be curious to know. Generally, though, what happens if you're someone who supports Trump, what I have observed is when he says stuff like that, they shake their head and like, yeah, you know, he talks a lot, he's pigheaded, that's who he is, but I like what he's doing and I like what he's getting done. And right. So I don't believe that this in any way was any different.
That's my I've actually started listening to Ben Shapiro's show a little bit. I haven't started to listen, but I've listened to a few at the behest of our good friend Tony, who's a conservative. And I find that that's also what he does. He kind of, you know, diminishes the importance of what Trump says by making fun of him. And that's an interesting, you know, even in his camp, there's a little bit of that when you're trying to appear more neutral. I would have a lot of things to say about Ben Shapiro, and I think I might talk about this a little bit later.
It sounds we'll like he's that. Really, he espouses the same views that I heard Scaramucci give in an interview with The Economist, which... If you are interested in understanding, not just disagreeing, but understanding the Republican side of this, and you don't, listen to Scaramucci's interview with The Economist, because Scaramucci was the guy who famously, you know, lasted a few weeks in the administration, but he had been part of the Trump campaign before that. And he lays it out very clearly in a way that if Democrats don't listen to what he is saying, they will not win the presidency in 2020.
Right. I didn't listen to Shapiro's reaction about this comment specifically, but in general, and I would suspect that was the same
thing. Yeah, it feels like the same thing. Scaramucci's criticism of the president is that he's pigheaded,
right?
That he gets his back up and he says things because he's angry.
Yeah.
But you know, and I think that's the thing that the Democrats are not understanding, and they're going to lose.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of that's a completely different conversation, and we will have it at some point. But I could discuss it as well. But yeah, so from here, we didn't really understand much of what was happening. But the thing our mind races to, I think, when we hear about these things, is climate change. And that's kind of, I don't think we're thinking, oh, this is all because of climate change, but immediately what we're thinking is climate change, which is man caused, can't be helping this situation. And that's, I think, the framing for this news that we have in Europe.
It's a little glib to go. It's not quite the same extent, but it's a little glib to say now we will use this tragedy that's killing people to fight, for climate change. But at the same time.
So, sorry, let me interrupt. I want to add, we're not using it to think, oh, this would be good ammo to fight climate change. That is not the way we're framing it. And I want to make this clear. I think we're, in France at least, most of us are very cognizant of the fact that climate change is real. And so when we see this, it's kind of impossible to dissociate the two and think, and we think, well, it can't help, but we're not thinking, oh, look, we're going to point to this and say, look, climate change is real, so we have to fight it. That's not at all where we're going. It's just, well, this seems to be linked to that, probably. Well,
first of all, I wasn't accusing you of that. I was saying it could be glib if you did that.
Right.
But to the point that I was going to try to make there was, while that could be considered a problem, it is true that the fact that we have less rain in California is one of the anticipated effects, and the dryness is one of the anticipated effects. So it's something you're going to have to get used to here in this part of the world, that we are going to continue to be at a higher risk of fire. We're going to be at a higher risk of drought, and that's just the way it's going to be, and it's not going to get better.
Yeah, we could talk about climate change and these issues at length. What kind of depresses me in advance is that, you know, a large part of my audience, of the audience for this show, is in the US. And I think immediately that audience would frame this discussion by attributing one opinion or the other to one or the other parties. And
yeah, no, it's the sickness we have in the United States is that everybody, like I said, it's a team sport now. So you can't have an actual opinion. You have to pick the opinion that goes with your team.
Exactly,
and if you pick an opinion that is not on that team, then people assume you're on the other team.
Exactly. And reality doesn't necessarily have a team. And either climate change is real or it isn't. I mean, it's pretty...
Also, I hate all the teams. They're crappy teams.
Honestly. And okay,
it's not even Premier League. It's not even second division. It's just the worst.
This is also another conversation.
yeah, I know. We're having 15 different conversations
at the same time, but that's how it goes. I wish our entire life could be a Helios Club episode where we just all speak in a friendly manner to one another. Bruce, anything you want to add about the forest fires before I conclude this episode with Finnish babies and jackets for drivers? You're muted.
No, I think that's fine. Thanks.
Okay. a couple of things I wanted to mention, and one very quick and one a little bit more lengthy. The first one is birth rates in Finland, which the latest report from the national organization agency that manages or at least reports on these things is quite dire. The birth rate in Finland has fallen to, I believe, 1.48, which is obviously not good if you want to renew the population. And looking at it from the French perspective, it was really interesting because in France, we have a higher birth rate and we have tax incentives for people who have several children. I mean, already from the first child, you get your general, you know, revenue tax reduced for having a child. If you have two children, again, it's reduced. If you have three, it's reduced more. And you get all sorts of benefits for what we call famille nombreuse, which is large family, I guess. And so this is a very healthy way, I think, to encourage people to have children, which is I guess for me, it seems healthy because it feels natural. Like Western societies have a tendency to have less children than others. And so you need to encourage it. And in order to do that, you need government, quote unquote, intervention. So this feels very natural. Another thing that you need if your population is declining is possibly to have immigration. That's a great way of adding workforce age people to your population. And sometimes they will even have higher birth rates than your current population. That is also something that helps the French population not grow but diminish less than it would it does in other countries, we have some immigration. And Finland is very, very adverse to immigration. Like, they do not want other people. I mean, surely if you're the color of your skin is lighter, you're probably okay to immigrate. I didn't have a lot of issues. Well, I'm in the EU, so they didn't have a choice. But yeah, they don't really like immigration. So more than most other countries, which, by the way, is probably due more to the fear that the Russians start to immigrate than to the fear that, well, I don't know, they don't really like those dark-skinned people. And I'm casting a wide net. I know not everyone's like this in Finland. But still, immigration is a no-go. So I think they're going to have to change their stance on tax incentives, which, about time, is my reaction. I wonder if you guys have any different reaction to the issue of birth rate and how to encourage higher birth rates, which obviously are needed in many parts of our Western countries.
Yeah, I mean, well, I feel like, and I don't know if Bruce will agree with this, but I'm sitting in a country who doesn't have that problem because of immigration, and immigration is the bigger issue, right?
So you're solving it with Mexicans that have lots of babies that will grow up to be criminals, well, essentially.
Or cowboys. They could, you know.
They could, yeah.
Despite both, their mama's best wishes. it's not an issue. It's not something that is on the national agenda here. The idea is we have too many people coming into the country, seems to be what most people want to talk about. We're not giving enough birth. It would be an interesting gambit for one of the parties to take this up as its cause. To say, you know what, this problem is, we need to have more babies in the United States. But I don't think they will. And it is a trend that isn't moving as fast as a lot of scientists thought it would. But as countries do develop, they tend to have lower birth rates. It's a big problem in Japan.
Oh, yeah. In Japan, it's crazy. Like, people aren't even getting married. It's like insane. But in Japan, it has more to do with social skills and social awkwardness, which is like a plague. But just for a little bit of context, in the US, the birth rate is 1.8, which isn't too bad. In the UK, it's 1.8 as well. In France, it's 1.96. So that's really good in our, you know, nations.
Well, you know, they say French is for lovers. So
there you go. Exactly. I guess the UK doesn't really have a big problem as well with this. They have immigration, which is also a big problem. Not to say that immigration is not considered a problem in France, but in this regard, it definitely helps. I guess the UK, it's not a problem either.
No. You know, you'd get people who say otherwise, but I know lots of our workforce and the care industry has a lot of immigrants. So. Right.
Okay. Mm. So there you go. That was the immigration. The birth rate thing. The other thing, which is actually, I'm burying the lead a little bit. It's a French movement that has been taking flight or importance in the past. Oh, can you mute yourself, Bruce? You're
sorry,
making a lot of noise. The yellow jackets movement, which is not the other name of Ant-Man throughout his illustrious career. It's those, as we were talking about in the beginning of the show, those reflective jackets that you put on when you go out on the street. If your car is on the side of the road and you have an issue, when you know to be seen. And that started as a protest against the increase of gas prices in the country. And it sort of ballooned into a complaint against the increase of the cost of living, and has become a national movement. The peculiar thing about it, or I guess we've seen it somewhere else, which is the point I'm going to make, but the peculiar thing is that it is not a politically led movement. It's not like the France Insoumise, which is the most natural political party to spearhead these kinds of things, because it's the far left movement that was quite successful in the last election. So it doesn't come from there, even though they've been, you know, screaming about these things for a long time. It doesn't come from the far left, the far right either, even though, again, they have been saying things like this for a long time. But it's really an anonymous citizen movement in the same way that we've seen for Occupy Wall Street and other similar movements, where it's very difficult to deal with because they have no leader. They have no demands. They have no agenda. And it's just a bunch of people going down in the street saying we're unhappy about the cost of living. And what they're doing specifically is stopping cars from going on the street. So they're going to do demonstrations where they go in the street and block the circulation, the traffic in the street. And it's happening in more and more cities, usually without any casualties or without any problem. It's relatively good-spirited. But there is one planned in Paris for this weekend. And this is the one that people are a little bit afraid about, because since there's no organization behind it, it's difficult to make sure things go well. And it's also very difficult to make sure that people who come to just break stuff, as happens with every demonstration, don't take part in that movement. And it seems like it's going to be a significant one in Paris this week, this weekend. And obviously, it is very much against, you know, anti the government and what it's been doing. And it's saying that the cost of living are increasing. We are but poor citizens, and you don't care about us, and you should pay attention to us a little bit more, or a lot more. And yeah, that is how I can characterize it at this point. I have no idea where it's going to go. It could die down after this weekend. It could flare up into a full-blown movement that would bring down the government. I have no idea. It's nowhere near that at this point. We've seen a bunch of, you know, people, and whatever happens in those cases is happening now, meaning you have pictures on Twitter that are showing immense masses of yellow jacket wearing people in the streets, and then people noticing that those pictures are either from other events or have been doctored, but not before they have been retweeted thousands of times. And overall, I think the movement is not super like, there aren't a huge amount of people doing it, but of course, with our current world, anyone doing something has a voice that is heard throughout the country. So it's making a lot of noise. And I guess the real test is going to be what's going to happen this weekend in Paris, because there you can actually see and count and realize for real what is happening. And if it's a large movement, it will have an impact. If it's a small movement, it might die down. But again, the most interesting part of it is the fact that no leader, it's like a citizens movement.
Interesting, Patrick. I'm just looking at it. It says the site I'm saying is that there've been two deaths and like almost 500 wounded. Am I looking at the right thing? Yeah, yellow vest protest. That sort of thing in the UK would be classed as riots, I suppose, with police wounded as well. And it's interesting, the French, there's a view of the French here as always protesting, but
I mean, I hadn't even heard about the deaths. I haven't been following it incredibly closely. But
there was one situation where someone's car was being jostled by a dozen protesters, right. And then she ran, she sort of hit the accelerator and I think killed somebody because she panicked. Right.
Yeah, I think, yes, I had heard about that one. But that tells you something. It doesn't really hit the threshold of, in that case, it should be prevented. It's just incidents happen when you have these kinds of things that are that take place. And we don't take away people's right to demonstrate. And sometimes they get a little bit rowdy, I suppose. But yeah. Overall, the current news climate is that they are the opposite of rowdy. They are behaving well, and yeah, so
it's definitely. I wonder. It's a different type of populist movement, isn't it? That's coming out.
It's almost like it's actually grassroots, not.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
absolutely. It's definitely grassroots. I mean, there are reports currently of the movement being radicalized to some extent, and it's hard to know if the government is kind of pushing this narrative to kind of try and split the movement, which might be the case. But it's definitely grassroots, to the dismay of political parties like the France Insoumise and the Front National, or whatever the name of that movement has become now. Marine Le Pen's movement is, I think it's, I can't remember. Because they would have liked to initiate these kinds of things. But it's 100% more Occupy Wall Street than it is a political party-led thing.
I do think that one thing... folks who have been on the side that benefited from Brexit or Make America Great Again may not realize is there is an underlying frustration that those movements took advantage of that the prescriptions of those movements don't solve. And I feel like what you're seeing here is like the real frustration coming out of that. No, it's not about your cause. It's about our life.
A little bit, yeah. I think there's definitely there seems to be like an untouchable consciousness in that movement, which warns the political parties against trying to take it as their own cause. They don't want to be récupéré, we say in French, to be taken over or used by political parties. And smartly, the parties are staying away from that idea. They're saying, you know, explicitly saying, we don't want to use that movement, but you are, you know, they're all trying to play around it and try to see how it would benefit their cause, which is legitimate because many of the demands, they don't even have demands, which is weird. They're just saying it's too, things are too expensive.
That is very Occupy Wall Street, isn't it?
Yeah. So... I don't know. I guess go ahead, Bruce.
It just feels I have a very unoriginal, idea in that it's what's fueling most of the world's unrest right now is inequalities. It's it goes back to the 1% and the people, and it's just getting worse and worse and worse. And actually, the UK is one of the worst now since Brexit. Mm. People are getting poorer, and that's what fueled Brexit, was exactly what Tom was saying, was that, you know, there are people out there who are disenfranchised and life is getting harder for most people, while I don't know, I still believe in universal. I'm starting to see more and more that universal basic income is the answer to a lot of the world's problems. But that would mean people at the top giving up their
you're taking it to like a super like far conclusion. But
yeah, well, Patrick's already hearing the emails he's getting from the people who oppose basically.
I agree with a lot of what you're saying, Bruce. But I've been reading the book by Harari. You know, Yuval Noah Harari, The 21 Lessons for the 21st Century. Really interesting. I mean, he takes a lot of things to some extremes, but a lot of super interesting contextualizations of what's been happening in this, in these past few years. And I think one of the things that actually I have been thinking and saying for a while, which he also puts into words, is this idea that the 1% is an issue. And I think it's very easy to do something which I do and used to do more, which is say, well, you know, what are people complaining about? We all have, you know, cell phones and enough money to eat. Yeah, you might not eat at the restaurant every night, but you have enough money to eat. 100 years ago, we would starve every couple of years, overdoing it, of course. But, you know, that idea that now the basic standard of living is so high that we shouldn't be complaining. And I still think that's true. However, what is also true is that issues inside societies arise not from the objective standard of living, but from the gap between the lower class and the upper class. And that gap, I think, has been widening. And that is definitely a concern.
Yep.
And if you don't want to have these kinds of things happen in your society, you need to make sure that you have a giant middle class and as little as possible lower class and as little as possible upper class. Doesn't mean you're not going to have issues, but creating a middle class is super, super important, regardless of what the objective standards are for any class. So, and this, as I guess, Tom, that's what you were saying, this movement, I think, is an expression of people not fed up with the way they're living, because I think the people going in the street are not all super poor, but it's just this feeling that some people are getting more, a bigger part of the pie or cake, and it's unfair, this feeling of unfairness.
And they want their eggs back from that cake to bring it full circle.
Thankfully, in France, we're not talking about getting the eggs back yet. It might come to that at some point.
Well, but I do think, you know, I think it is, you can get caught up with, oh, it's the 1%, you know, and then the argument is like, well, what? It's bad to have rich people. You need that motivation to be rich. It's not about rich or poor, in my opinion. It's about a relative difference between opportunity. It's not, as you said very well, it's not about I'm living badly. It's I'm not living as well as I see I could live, and I don't feel like it is within my reach. The system won't allow me to get there. That's the problem that I think some of the people who are on the 1% side, or the, you know, well, it's you know, we don't want to just take away all the rich people's gains. They worked hard for that. They don't realize it's not about taking away. It's about keeping the gap within reasonable distance so that everyone feels like they can achieve an improvement in their life. Too many people don't feel like an improvement to their life is possible right now. That, to me, is the biggest problem.
I think in the US it's especially true. I think in France maybe it's a little bit different overall, but regardless of the particular situation of each country, there is also a reality which is difficult to deny unless you willfully are trying to. And that's the reality that this middle class, if it thins out, then you're going to have trouble. It doesn't matter why. It doesn't matter who is rich and if they don't want to give their money to have it taken by the government or the poor or whatever. It doesn't matter. What matters is that if you don't have a large middle class, you're going to have these tensions. And the thinner the middle class gets, the more intense those tensions start to become. And that is just, you know, it's just fact. I think, I'm going to put a little caveat there, I think. It's just, that's how it works. That's how reality works.
That's also called a strong opinion when it's a fact, I think.
Yes, also, maybe. I don't, but I think there is something to that. And in France, it's not as bad as it is in other countries, but yeah, Tom.
How do you create that middle class then? Sorry.
Honestly, I think part of it is making sure that, and we're veering off different topics again, but I think it's making sure that everyone has access to affordable healthcare, education, and these kinds of things that make that difficulty less than it would be otherwise. In France, we have, at least, you know, you're not going to die if you get sick. Your children are going to get a chance to have an education no matter where they're from and what they do. So I guess that speaks to what Tom was saying. You have a feeling like, well, you're not going to have to sell your house, which is already on a mortgage, if you get cancer, right? So, or if you break your leg or whatever. So I think that plays into this idea that the middle class is, you know, through means attainable for more people. And again, I think this movement in France is part of that issue, probably. But I also think it's lessened by the fact that we have those safety nets that work for the entire population. So the class warfare, quote unquote, no matter what people tell you in the populist movements, I think is a lot less strenuous in France than in some other countries. Maybe I'm wrong there. All right.
I think my views have gone more and more extreme as time's gone on, and it might be worth it, maybe we can have an episode later. I don't know.
About
podcast, but I think the idea of universal basic income is as the world gets more automated, I don't know.
Well,
creating a middle class, do we have the jobs to do that? Do we have, we've got enough food in the world. It's just a question of distribution, et cetera, et cetera. I don't know. There's lots of very naive points that I find very frustrating
to speak about.
It's a new problem. That's why it's so frustrating. The problem isn't that people starve. It's that people may not get enough. The problem isn't that we are unable to cure illnesses. It's that we may not have it distributed properly. Accessibility. We've gone from we need to solve the fact that people are dying out in the fields, people aren't living as well as we could make them live, which is a great problem, but it's a different problem, and old solutions aren't going to work for it. So basic income is a really interesting thing. It's been tried in a few places. We've learned how it doesn't work, how it does work. And so whether basic income is the solution or not, I don't know, but it's certainly something to look at and study. And even if it's not the solution, trying it and experimenting with it and studying it is probably going to help lead us to the solution of what do we need to do. I mean, we basically have socialized clothing in the world ad hoc. Nobody is going around naked in the world because there's so much clothing and people just give it away. And no one's objecting like, this giving away of clothing is just a horrible thing. How dare we? Right. Because we have so much abundance that it's solved itself. So, there's something to the fact that we can solve this stuff. We just need to try.
I suppose in the Western world, there are very few people who are actually starving to death at the moment. There are people who struggle, but so that is I wouldn't say solved, but and I think
in the process,
Europe, in all parts of the world,
Europe has solved to a good extent the NHS, healthcare system, because we do have socialized healthcare that works. It's not perfect. I don't think any human system ever will be.
But, I think. Honestly, again, anyway, I know this comes as a shock to our American listeners, but everyone in the West, in the Western world has solved universal healthcare to different degrees and with problems, but everyone but the US. That is,
have you solved how to disincentivize large company interests from undermining solving healthcare? That's the problem in the US.
Yes, of course, of course. But I mean,
that, let us know, because that's our problem.
Well, I mean, I don't know about that specifically, but we did solve healthcare. And I think a lot of people don't see see healthcare in itself as an issue. And okay, let's not get dragged into a healthcare conversation again. But the fact is, in Europe, in all of the Western world, healthcare is no longer an issue as a concept. Yes, there are ways of implementing it, and people argue about this.
It's been solved everywhere in Africa, has it?
No, I'm saying in the Western world.
Mm-hmm.
Like in first world countries, definitely not in Africa. But about universal basic income, I was befuddled by the idea, but the more I thought about it, I think it is interesting. And as Tom said, I think it should be tried. I think there is something to it. And interestingly, Harari talks about it quite a bit as well, as one of the maybe things we might need to implement for other reasons. Again, that book is really interesting. Go check it out.
And a couple of places where it's been tried, it hasn't worked out as the believers expected. It hasn't been necessarily a failure, but it hasn't provided quite the effect that folks wanted. So, and I'm not saying that to say it's a bad idea. I'm saying it's not going to work the way everybody thinks until we do this, till we try it and figure out, well, maybe it's not basic income. Maybe it's this other way of doing it. Maybe it's some voucher system. I don't even know.
I think it's being tried still, including in Finland, in a few places. Mm-hmm. And I think it would be unconscionable, and no one is saying this, that you should implement universal basic income for a whole country from one day to the next.
Right.
That is ridiculous. And you don't know what would happen is playing with fire. But trying it here and there and see what happens seems like a reasonable way to do it.
I wonder if it's one of those things. It's like it's almost like Obamacare. You can't half implement socialized medicine because it won't work. You can't sort of take you can't take one state and say, I don't know, what's an American state?
Iowa.
Ohio.
Ohio. Take Ohio and say, you know, you're all going to have socialized medicine.
I don't know. I think you could.
Massachusetts did it.
Yeah, so. I think scale of a state is enough that you could do. Depending on the state, but.
Maybe you can't take a town, though. Like a single town. Yeah, it works fairly well in Massachusetts, despite what the Republicans would like you to think, because it was implemented by Republican Mitt Romney.
More about that. Oh,
yeah. But we need to go, unfortunately. All the topics, all the conversations in the world would be super interesting, but we only had time for a few today, and I want to thank both of you for indulging me and the audience for indulging us talking about all of this. If people want to get in touch with you guys and hear more about what you're doing, what would you recommend they do? Let's start with Bruce.
I'm just on Twitter. I'm a regular person who doesn't podcast as Patrick and Tom do. You can catch me on Bruce Woodward 3. I've only got a couple of hundred followers, and I'm a very sad and depressed father who just plods along in Scotland and tries to do the right thing.
I'm sure you're going to get lots of people to get in touch with you with that description.
What was the account again?
Bruce Woodward 3. I mainly been, I don't know, I shit post a lot, so there we go.
Well, I'll include the link in the show notes so people who want to hear from a sad and depressed father of three from Scotland can do that.
Yeah, I think it's sad cat as his avatar.
Which one is that? Yeah, I'd forgotten that one. Anyway, sorry.
I think it's also good to have an interesting perspective on that part of the world. The cat isn't sad. He's
concerned, maybe.
No, it's a Black Panther, right? Oh. It's a Black Panther cat.
Oh, is it? Not. Oh, okay. I
don't know. Maybe not. He looks very
Black Panther. It's a baby Black Panther. Yeah.
Oh, there you go.
Yes. Now I see. I see the necklace. Now I get it.
Mm-hmm. Oh, somebody famous just followed me.
Tom Merritt, you seem famous. Where would people get a hold of you?
I am an irregular person because I do lots of podcasts, and you can find them at tommerritt.com. One that is probably most relevant to people who might be listening to the Phileas Club is the Daily Tech News Show, because we talk about tech news and how it affects the world. Patrick Beja is one of our regular contributors, co-hosting the show mostly on Tuesdays, and you can find that at dailytechnewsshow.com.
Excellent. For me, it's Not Patrick. Yes, that's my name on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Very easy, Not Patrick. See, you already remember it. It's Patrick with a not in front of it. FrenchSpin.com for the blog with the all of the podcasts that I do and the updates and the articles where you can come and comment on what we said. And if you really enjoy the show, if you had a good time, if you like what you heard, if you think it provides any kind of service to you, then you can also support it on Patreon at patreon.com/thePhileas Club. The link is in the show notes as well, so you can go check that out and become a supporter. It would be immensely appreciated because this show is entirely powered by Patreon. So thanks a million to those who already do it. You are the best people in the world, whatever your party allegiances are. I love all of you, and we will be back in a few weeks for a new episode. Talk to you then. Bye. Ooh, and happy Thanksgiving.
Happy Thanksgiving, other Usans.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.